Hey everybody, Rob Maurer here, and today we have the good fortune to be joined by Jimmy Soni, who is the author of a book that was published earlier this year, The Founders, which covers the story of Elon Musk and PayPal, the very early days, all the way through the eventual merger, you know, IPO, merger with PayPal, or merger with eBay rather, and then the eventual spinoff back just to PayPal. So tons of interesting stuff in here. I think the timing could not be any better with what we've got going on with Elon and Twitter lately, so I found it super insightful just to learn a little bit more about Elon and you know, those early days. This must have been a ton of work. Anyway, Jimmy, thanks for joining. You want to give a quick intro and synopsis of that?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I don't want to say much more than that. It was a great intro, but I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me, taking time to read the book, which is called The Founders. You had mentioned the one piece of it, which it was a lot of work. It was sort of 6 years of research and interviewing and time end to end. And the joke, one board member like gently ribbed me. He was like, "You spent more time writing the book than I spent creating the company."
That's actually amazing.
I was like, "Whoa, that's a sick burn," but really accurate too. But yeah. I wanted to get into the weeds on the creation of PayPal and understanding Elon and others, and so that's why it took as long as it did. But I really appreciate you having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you say that because I know the timeline for PayPal going to like kind of, you know, first initial founding and then like an IPO, it's also compressed into like a 3 year period there basically. So yeah, like twice as long doing the research on that period of time to do it. But you know, they got a whole team of hundreds of people and you're
exactly.
Just, you're just working
as
your own.
This was an army of one. This was me in my room.
Exactly. No, you did an awesome job with it though. That's funny too, because the first question that I wrote down when I started listening to this after like the first couple of chapters, I was just like, man, the attention to detail, which I'm all about that stuff, like is fantastic in this book. And the first question I wrote down was just how many hours did you spend on this? I know it was 6 years, so you probably don't even have really an idea of it, but
I'll answer the question and maybe it'll give a window into the process, which, you know, I find that with these kinds of projects, I'm sure this was true for you, when you do discover your systems and methods as you're creating the thing, right? And for me, what happened is that over the course of that, like the time definitely increased, you know, as you get closer to publication. And what I would say is that it would be in the thousands of hours easily, right? Just because it takes a while. But part of what I wanted to try to do with the book was not make up a story. So you'll notice that like it's a long book, but actually part of the reason for the length is that there's like 100 pages of endnotes at the very end. So everything is cited and like sourced. And so at my challenge or the place on the Venn diagram I was going for was like, could you write a book that is fun to read, right? That like actually people could like get through and enjoy, but that also doesn't just like make up facts, right? And actually like has rigorous research behind it. And that was the sweet spot in the middle that I was aiming for. And it's why it took as long as it did. Like the truth is like even the fact checking at the very end took like 3-4 months, like just to go through with an outside fact checker and say like, where'd you get this? Where'd you learn this? Show me the document for this. And so that's what took a lot of time. But basically I spent, you know, the honest answer is I spent every day working on it in some capacity. Most mornings, like between like 4:30 a.m. and 9 a.m. is like when I would devote to this project. And that was partly because I had hundreds of people to interview, including Elon, and thousands of pages of documents because someone shared a big email archive. So once that happened, I was like, this is pay dirt. Like now, even if it took 10 years, I was like, I've got to do this the right way as opposed to trying to rush through it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm super appreciative that you spent the time to do that. It's, you know, it's not a guarantee that someone would do that, right? Like, it's not a guarantee that this book would be written at some point if you didn't step up and spend all that time to do that. I think, you know, some of this insight and information, you know, just could have gotten lost, could have gotten not reported on. So I'm happy to have it. I would definitely recommend the book to everybody. You know, I've got it sitting right here next to me.
Cool.
Like you said, enjoyable read. And yeah, tons of insight. So I want to definitely get into all that stuff. I will put a link to it in the description. So again, definitely recommend it to everybody. I think probably the most poignant thing right now is a lot of the concepts that, you know, are discussed in the book, early days with X.com, which eventually merged with Confinity, which became PayPal. There's a lot in there about, you know, Elon's grand vision that never really materialized. And we've heard him talk a lot about that through this Twitter process. And, you know, this book was published before all of this kind of became what it is today. How has that, been for you? How has that granted you insight into kind of what Elon has been talking about over the last few months? Just kind of, how do you think about what has materialized since the publishing of the book, I guess?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I'm not trying to duck it when I say that one of the things I tried to do, and this is also advice for anybody who writes this kind of book in the future, this is like my message in a bottle to future writers, is when I was in the middle of writing the book, one of the things that I tried to discipline myself to do was to avoid all the news that I could about Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, Max Levchin, and David Sacks. But there, and it's not just for like personal sanity, which like that certainly is part of it. It's also because I was writing about the period like 1998 to 2002. And if you get too swept up into, oh my God, Elon Musk is hosting SNL, then you actually like distract yourself from, well, hold on, what was happening in 1999 and 1990 and 1998 and 2000, 2001, 2002. So I came out of that little bubble. Just as the book is published, and then all the Twitter stuff happens, and so it sort of went from like a trickle to a flood, and I like had been avoiding water for all that time, right? But what I would say is just to take a step back, I think that one of the things that is clear to me, and this is kind of to your earlier point, is almost inevitably the misunderstanding of what he is trying to do with, say, Twitter or Tesla or SpaceX or any of the like the amount of time it took me to wrap my head around what he wanted X.com to be and to really get into it and to talk with him about it and to talk to other people who were there and to find citations and to look at old PowerPoint decks and to look at emails. There's an enormous amount of work, and I still feel like if you told me to go back, I could like write a new version of the book and upgrade my understanding. Which is all to say that like the hot takes about Twitter, I think, are like the story's not over, and like we don't know what's going to happen, right? I had read somewhere yesterday that there's some book that's already been sold, it's already finished, and it took like 6 months to write. And I'm thinking to myself like, it took me 6 months to fact check my book, like what, and also we don't know the conclusion, like what's the last scene, so I would just say that I think what you, there's a long way to answer your question, but I sort of come at some of the daily news with a healthy dose of skepticism because I saw how misunderstood the PayPal story was, and I appreciated how long and how many miles I had to log just to talk to the people who gave me the insights necessary to try to do a better job of that story, which is all to say, like, I think it's one of the things I sort of noticed about your work. Like, you kind of, I think, found, you were like, look, I think this thing about Tesla, but all the media says this, but they're wrong. Like, I want to find out more. I will, like, with some asterisks and caveats, like, I think that a lot of what people are saying about the last few months just isn't based in fact. And I think a lot of the things that are being written by people who don't have much access to him. And I'm not saying that like that's a necessarily a prerequisite, but I think if my understanding of Twitter and that whole thing is different having done this book. And part of the difference is that when he speaks about refocusing the company around engineering and product and about the intensity of the work culture and even about some of the email messages about, the kind of adventure that the engineers are signing up for, I see it differently having studied the X.com story and understanding that. So that's one big part of it. The second thing I think is there's so many people, and I'm sure you've noticed this, who like don't remember that there were two companies before Tesla and SpaceX. One was called Zip2 and the other was called PayPal. And Elon was a co-founder of both of those companies, and they were web companies. Now, early web, admittedly, but I think like there's this whole amnesia, like as though this person just emerged at 50 years old and like decided to do a thing. Where like part of the value of studying someone's early life is you see how they became the person they became. So for me, I think to myself, like, look, he's been in the internet game a very long time, and has built Zip2 and sold it to Compaq Computer and helped to build half of PayPal, and then that company IPO'd, and he was intimately involved in both of those companies. And I sort of like I look a little bit quizzically at people who are like, well, he has no idea what he's doing. I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? He's been doing the internet since like before the internet was cool. So that's my admittedly uninformed perspective, because I think all of us are uninformed, right? Because that's the truth of it. Like it takes a long time, as you can appreciate, to understand even the basic workings of one of these companies. And so for people to be writing like, "Oh, it's the end of Twitter," or "Oh, it's like it's a little premature.
Yeah, no, I mean, tons of things you're saying in there that I agree with. It's super interesting. Even going back to like Elon's like very earliest job or his internship, at whatever bank that was, and you just talking about how he kind of recognized this opportunity for these debt assets that were pretty newly created that could have generated like billions of dollars of returns. And he's like a 19-year-old intern at this bank, and no one listens to him, and he just kind of says like, all right, and it's kind of eye-opening to him, and he realized just like the opportunity for disruption. And I think that's what, alongside many other skills, that's what Elon has just always had. Like whatever the industry he's in, he sees those things. He's very much a visionary, and I think that's what he's seeing with Twitter, and he's seeing that opportunity, and he's gonna take advantage of it. And it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be chaotic, and a lot of people just look at chaos and they just see the chaos. But I think Elon looks at that and he sees like, the beauty within the chaos as well. And as I was reading this and kind of the early days of PayPal, and they're doing the same stuff that Twitter's doing, like engineers sleeping under their desks and stuff like that. It's just like, man, it's 20 years later, but it's exactly what's happening with Twitter
It's
right
the
now. I
same.
mean, like right after that
Yeah,
acquisition
it's the
closed,
same.
Elon's tweeting out these pictures of like work sessions at 1 a.m. And I was like, this is just he's living back in his glory
Well,
days of like of PayPal.
and it's funny that you say that, because if there are photos that were shared with me through some of the employees that I interviewed over the course of my research, and you could al it's almost like a mirror image, that the photo that you're speaking of is the photo that he tweeted at 2 a.m. with all the engineers. I have like identical photos from X.com and from PayPal. And if you take a step back, now people could say that and say, well, that's not really, accurate, or that's not a fair comparison. Here's where here's where it rhymes and the importance of it, which is, I've been trying to like think about this like and take a step back and say to myself, like, what exactly does it mean when he says things like extremely hardcore? Or like, what does it mean to like want to take this company and turn it around and change it? And part of what I think he does, and you would understand this better than I would, is he ramps up the urgency, what he's called like maniacal urgency, right? And there is an urgency to the way that he does business that I think inspires a certain kind of person, particularly engineers who want to meet these big challenges that he has set out for the team. And I bet that if you were to talk to the people on that in that photo, the Twitter photo, they would talk about how they're like working harder than they ever have, but they also feel like they are a part of something like big and consequential and important. And it doesn't mean it's always pleasant. It doesn't mean everybody gets along all the time. But my sense is that it's actually very hard for a leader to manufacture that kind of urgency. And it's like the thing that I saw at X.com was people signed up because he said they were going to like take on every bank in the world, right? And I had multiple people who, to this day, like when they spoke about it, they would get fired up and they were like, "Elon said we're gonna take down JP Morgan, we're gonna do this and we're gonna like beat these people." And you wanna sign up for that. You wanna man the barricades for something like that. And that is very different than like a vision that is, let's say, like, "Oh, we're gonna like incrementally improve revenue by 5% quarter after quarter," and so I think that people miss this texture, and like I would miss it too, by the way, if I hadn't like gone and done a crazy deep dive into the origins of PayPal. I wouldn't understand that what he is saying is sort of like what Shackleton said, like when he signed people up for that like epic quest, like, "This is gonna be hard. This is gonna be like often terrible. You're gonna be cold and wet and freezing. You're not gonna see your families, but it is like an epic story you'll live to tell forever." I often feel like he's just channeling Shackleton, right? And I will say it's hugely inspiring for the people who choose to sign up. Not always pleasant, but hugely inspiring.
Yeah, you mentioned like talking to people, and even today, 20, 15 years later, people are still getting like fired up about like that initial vision and stuff like that. When you talked to Elon, did you kind of get that sense from him too? Like he's still pretty fired up about that?
100%. And actually, what's really interesting is you sort of touched on this, which is, there are visions, business visions that Elon has had that he has managed to fulfill. Whether that is reusable rockets, the fast forwarding of electric cars, et cetera, right? PayPal is a story of a vision unfulfilled, because his vision for X.com was much bigger than what PayPal became. So what, it's actually funny, now that you're asking me the question, I'm thinking about this really funny moment that's in the book, that it's like one of my favorite lines. And like, it became like a little running joke among my friends, because we were talking about how he believed then and believes now that if you are a financial institution and you want all the money in the world to be with you, you have to provide the resources and tools that anybody uses to manage their money in any format. So if you don't have a debit card, you're kind of like cutting out people who like debit cards. If you don't have a credit card, same thing. His thing was, he was still disappointed to this day that modern PayPal does not have paper checks, because he said, like, if you still use paper checks to manage your money, then by definition, like, we can't, you know, you can't work with an institution that doesn't have them. And there's this great line that, like, we're talking about this and he's becoming really animated and passionate. And he looks at me and goes, like, sweet baby Jesus, give him goddamn checks. I just remember thinking, like, I've never met a human being who would be this fired up about checks, right? About paper checks. But he was, and it was amazing to watch, because you can tell where he begins is like first principles. Like, if I want all the money in the world as a financial institution, what does that mean? Well, it means providing every resource available. And if you don't have checks, you're not in the same game. And so I do see some of that. And like, there's this fire about the ideas around financial systems and around banking and around transactions that were very much like that fired him up 20 years ago. They are alive and well today.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be very interesting to see like how much of that gets incorporated. I know he had like a little, you know, Twitter 2.0 slideshow that he presented to employees, and you know, there was a payments section on that. We don't really know what that's going to entail necessarily, but like you said, his vision, you know, initially was really broad. So you mentioned kind of like,
you know,
go ahead.
Just a point on that, which I think is really important and particularly like relevant for people who are thinking about like the companies he's engaged in today. You know, there's this part of the story that I was looking at where I found this interview that he did that was like with Chinese television or something. And it's like, I had like very few video views, but I, you know, was doing exhaustive research to see anytime he'd mentioned PayPal. And in this interview, one of the things he said is you start out with a plan and the plan is mostly wrong. And what he's referring to is like any plan for a startup. He's like, you start out with a plan and the plan is mostly wrong, and you engage in a process of recursive self-improvement to get to the right answer. And so interestingly, like, I would bet that if you were to ask him about that presentation he just gave, he might say, I've learned something in a week that has forced me to change what that vision is. Like, or I've shifted the direction slightly, because that's actually like one of the upsides of a startup is the pace of learning can be quick enough to change the PowerPoint deck. And that actually like the PowerPoint decks go out the window the next day. And it was one of the things that I think people who are in tech understand this, but as somebody who came to this as a bit of an outsider, it like was really useful to understand that actually the point is that you change the next day, right? So people criticize like, oh, well, how come he didn't know what the pricing for Twitter Blue would be before it was announced, and then it was changed on the fly? It's because actually like one of the advantages of trying to run this company like a startup is on the fly changes to things like pricing that can be responsive to market feedback, right? And it was like a thing that I think it even as I say it out loud, it sounds brain dead obvious, except that it's not obvious at all. Like in most of our lives, that doesn't happen. In most of the products we interact with, that doesn't happen. But it's one of the cool things about doing this project was I sort of understood like, oh, actually, like what he's saying is you have a plan, but you know your plan's going to be wrong. The whole exercise is improvement.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it leaves Elon and the businesses he runs open to a lot of criticism. And I think we've seen this across the board, whether it's SpaceX, Tesla, now Twitter, where some action will be made and then there's a lot of criticism to it because it looks like something dumb, right? And that's what you're saying is like, yeah, it probably is dumb. And like, okay, we move on. Like we learn from that. And it's less dumb to make a decision that seems dumb than to sit there and waste, you know, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, to try to get something less dumb when you can just like go faster, figure it out, and then move on. Like, and that's what we're seeing probably more out in the open than with any other business that Elon's been involved in with Twitter, where it literally is instantaneous where we're seeing these things and, you know, Elon coming in there and learning all of this. And, you know, I think that's for me one of the things that makes it the most exciting, not to, you know, just focus in on Twitter this whole time, but I think that's what makes it most exciting is just that, you know, we get to see that and we get to see finally something like happening, right? Like Twitter has been the same for like a decade, right? You know, it's little changes here and there, but something like there's a breath of fresh air coming into it.
And I would say too, like, I'm not any kind of expert on that platform or on the changes he's making. And I haven't, we didn't, when we, when he and I spoke, it was not about social networks. It was about X.com and PayPal. But I think that the thing that the lens that I bring, having done the book, is I kind of understand what you said, which is that the chaos can be productive chaos. That actually, like, in the act of trying to change something, you can learn new things, right? And I think it's harder with a business where people feel like they have a personal attachment to it, like Twitter. Like, people are like, well, I have my blue check and I have my followers and I have my
Sure.
way of using this. And I think that's tough. Like, I think, you know, we get irrationally attached to the things as they are. It's probably in some ways easier. Like, if you're, you know, I don't think he could have done with Tesla what if somebody said, hey, Elon, like, you get to be CEO of Ford. Like, we're gonna go back to 2006 and make you like CEO of Ford Motor Company. That would like be really hard. You know, there's so much sunk cost, so many legacy parts to that business, so many ways in which you couldn't achieve what Tesla's achieved. In the same way, I think this is like that. It's like a really hard thing to move a supertanker with thousands of employees and a lot of like these things. It's hard to shift it in a different direction. But that, to me, it's like one of the things I like, I have more humility about jumping to conclusions about the Twitter story because I'm like, this is a playbook we've seen before, and it has virtues and vices, and we, you know, the story's still too early to tell.
Yeah, but it's definitely new, and I mean, even like it's kind of somewhat equivalent, I guess, to like when eBay eventually acquired PayPal after a lot of back and forth. It doesn't always just like integrate smoothly. And in a way, it's like Elon acquiring Twitter. Like that's literally what happened, and that comes with all of this culture and baggage that's already been created. It's not like Elon starting from scratch with Zip2, X.com, SpaceX, and Tesla. This is a maybe the same playbook, but in execution, a lot different, way that it's going to be have to be carried out. So, yeah, it's
Yeah.
going to be super interesting to see how that all happens.
I think that the one, you know, there are these features that I'm sure were true for the Tesla story, which I don't know quite as well as the X.com PayPal story. But, you know, one feature of the X.com story, like the early days, is just highly compressed timelines driven by, you know, a boss that sets an urgent schedule as well as limited funding available to win, right? And like you sort of see that in the, okay, if we want to get something done, we don't need to spend 2 months road mapping, right? And this was true, like for example, at X.com, they in the space of 3 months in 1999, X.com like built its site, signed a deal with Barclays, launched brokerage accounts and like really like built created the checkbooks you know and had a name and a kind of entity and an operation, and that was like that was people thought it would never happen. They said it was impossible, you couldn't do it that quickly, it was a highly regulated business, finance, but the team pulled it off. And I just sort of say this to like people see words like maniacal urgency and they roll their eyes. But like part of the story of early X.com is like, no, it's true. Like you can create leaders can create that urgency and then you can execute against it and you're not going to get it exactly right. But like by Thanksgiving of 1999, X.com is live. And 3 months before they had a shell of a website. So I having seen it, I'm like, you know, I understand what he is trying to do or the style that he is trying to do. I have no opinion on the goals or any of that because I just don't know enough. But I understand the approach, which is, boy, you can do a lot with engineers if you like set a very big goal and then go for it.
For sure. And it's definitely not always easy, and I think one of the things that's one of the periods of time in the book that is really interesting is learning a little bit more about the eventual exit from Elon's CEO position. And I think everyone's aware that that was him getting forced out at that period of time. And a couple things on that that I think are interesting. But yeah, I'd just love to hear your thoughts on that. I think one thing that's striking to me is just like how where we sit today and everything that's transpired, SpaceX and Tesla and how those have come to be, it's all just so, butterfly effect where if just these little things had been just a little bit different, like we might not have any of these companies. Elon might still be, X.com chairman and CEO, and it might dominate global financials instead of us having SpaceX and Tesla. Like that's a very reasonable outcome that's just like, maybe a couple of different moves away. So That was striking to me. It's not really a question, but you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's you described it beautifully, right? So if we just take a step back for listeners who might not be as familiar with the story, and particularly because of like how much misinformation there is about this episode, the modern PayPal is the merger of two companies. It fuses together a company called Confinity that was created by Max Levchin, Peter Thiel, and a handful of other named co-founders. And this company called X.com, which was created by Elon Musk. And these two companies joined forces in early 2000. They had been in this like really brutal competition with each other, like trying to spend each other into oblivion. There's a lot of funny moments. Elon's line about it for your listeners is like, he's like, we were going mental trying to kill each other. And it was like this great. But then he also said he was like, it was one of the first moments where he had met competitors in Max Levchin and Peter Thiel, where he was like, they could keep up with me. And like, he's like, and very few people can keep up with me technology. So if you can keep up with me, whoa, respect, right? There's this way he communicates that is like very endearing because it's just so funny. And he's like, whoa, respect. And so he has this sort of respectful competition, not exactly respectful, but he respects the people who he's
In
competing with.
hindsight, yeah.
Yeah, they decide to merge, and it's a messy merger. And what happens is like you went from essentially like being at daggers with each other, like trying to kill each other, to like having to like work together in the space of what, 8 to 12 weeks total in early 2000. So from roughly January to March of 2000. Now, fast forward and in September, there's a big difference of opinion on a bunch of things related to the business. And Elon at that point is in July and August of 2000, he's the CEO of the combined entity. And essentially, there's an effort made to push him out. And part of what I came to understand, that again, it's like not what you would read from, let's say, like the Wikipedia entry, right? Is, and this was explained to me by people on all sides. But that's the other thing. I spoke to all sides of this. Elon had a bigger vision for X.com and what he wanted it to do. He had a difference of opinion with the CTO about the technological architecture, and his vision was much bigger than person-to-person payments. But at the time, the people who opposed him thought that big vision might be right, but we don't have the capital and we're burning so much money in fraud that we'll never get there and we'll basically like collapse. And so they mount an effort, they go to the board, they oust him, a sort of famous story where he's on his honeymoon and he has to scramble to come back to fight for his position. And he ultimately does leave the company. And part of what I had that like gave me confidence that I was telling the truth is I had emails. I had like his resignation note to the company is in the book because I thought it was really informative about how he thinks about these things. Peter Thiel's note announcing his departure is in the book. And so I had these like documents, like kind of historical record that gave me insight into more than just like, oh, Elon was a really tough boss. It wasn't that at all. Like, there were serious differences of strategic vision about where the business was going to go. For Elon, X.com was going to be the global center for finance. If you and I wanted to take out a mortgage, X.com, checking, brokerage, like credit lines, credit cards, all of it, checking, checkbooks, all through X.com. And for people on the other side of that debate, PayPal was at the time a person-to-person payment system where you could send money very easily over email, and it had a fraud problem. And so the kind of their focus was like, we got to fix the fraud problem, and we have to go where we can be successful. In looking back at the story, part of what I was able to speak to Elon about is I said, look, walk me through your thinking. Like, what precipitated your like that whole thing? And he was very honest, actually. That was like one of the great things. He was really honest. He said, look, I had already sold a company for $300 million. It was called Zip2, and we talked about that too. But he said I had sold Zip2 for $300 million. So if that was the win, he's like, I just didn't like. I wanted a bigger win. I wanted to do something that was more consequential. And at the same time, like I would speak to the others, Peter and Max and David Sacks and others, and they would say, we appreciated that, and like they're like we admire like the bigness of the vision, but we just felt that it wasn't tenable. And then I think what I was able to do as an author is just like take a step back and say, look, let's look at context. Like, for people who oppose that vision, they haven't had a successful startup exit before. Like, these are people who are doing it for the first time, in some cases, and they don't have money. Like, nobody has an eight-figure net worth, right? And you have this person on the other side who you think, wow, he's like really intense, but he is trying to do something that's so big when the market is collapsing and like the Nasdaq goes down every day and it loses almost like I think 86% of its value over the course of the year 2000. In that context, and with that personal context, you can understand why there was a clash. But that challenges a lot of the narrative that's been sort of peddled in different places where they're like, oh, you know, Elon got kicked out of PayPal. Well, he did, but there's a whole sort of background here that matters a lot. The other thing that's important for people who are trying to follow him and understand kind of the business thinking is that in the aftermath, he doesn't burn the company to the ground. You know, like he's a board member. He buys more equity, actually, which I did not know until I did the research. He actually invests even more money in this company that unceremoniously had shown him the door. He says, no, it's still like a great company. I'm still going to like double down, you know? And so there's a part of this that just has a texture and a nuance that I think is sometimes like missing in some of these histories. And I can only say any of this because, again, I had access to these, to the notes that were exchanged and the kind of letters between people and some of the conversation that showed me like, no, this was a fundamental difference of vision about what the business was going to be. And you could almost understand why the argument happened. You're like, well, it makes sense. Like if I was in that situation, it probably would have happened to me. I would have had to choose sides. But importantly, there's no kind of flaming of the company. There's no burning it down. And the way you know that some of the hatchets have been buried is like some of the key investors in Tesla and SpaceX came out of the PayPal alumni group. You know, there are people who are connected to him, who have been connected to him since that time. These are the people who voted him out of the company. And he has them invest in him and they invest in it, meaning like both sides are actually agreeing to this. It's not some show, right? And so I think that's like part of what I walk away with is just a little bit of an appreciation for the coup, because it sounds really bad, right? You're like, oh, the guy's on his honeymoon, you throw him out of the company. And it is. It's really bad. And you know, I could tell even when I was interviewing him, it was still a painful moment. But the thing that was really illuminating was how much he had learned from it, and then also kind of understanding like, no, this wasn't just some like personal tiff. Like it wasn't like, oh, people didn't like each other. It was a strategic difference of vision. And that was what needed to be resolved at that time.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating to kind of read through that and just like see, it was pretty eye-opening for me, like the graciousness that Elon had immediately after that. Like it wasn't something that came with the benefit of, okay, this is an, you know, 15-year-old thing and like I've moved on at this point. It was pretty quick there that he was, you know, being supportive of, like you said, those people that just basically conspired against him and, you know, kicked him out of his position of the company on his honeymoon. Like that's, and I think it would be very easy to hold a grudge on that. And he doesn't seem like he really did. So it's, like, that's impressive to me. I don't know that I could do that.
No. And I would say that the other thing that often happens with the version of the PayPal story that others have written about is we forget how many of the key players were hired or recruited by him. So if you look at the list of executives on the document that the company submitted to the SEC when it was filing to go public, you point to names on that list, Roelof Botha, Todd Pearson, and they were hired by Elon. So there's been this whole sort of fiction that's developed, like he's not a co-founder. And you think to yourself, like, that's just flatly false, right? Even if you were only to concede that he hired like several of the most important executives at the company, even if that was it, you'd be like, well, that happened because of him. Like he created it, he hired them, he interviewed them, and they were part of a very small group of people. And I went through, you know, one of the things that was interesting is that, you know, because he was pushed out of the company, there were a number of stories written in the aftermath that neglected all of these other employees, right? But I was actually able to go back and interview some of them. And that's where the truth emerges, where they're like, look, when I interviewed with Elon directly, and he had this big thing about how we're going to change banking forever, and that's why I joined. And I'm thinking to myself, well, like, okay, there's not something there of like, oh, he was some distant chairman, you know, or he was like an investor or something. This was somebody who was actually one-on-one interviewing employees and then recruiting them. But I will say the other thing that it taught me was, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, that like, I know his humor doesn't always land, but he's a really funny guy. Like in talking about one of the most painful periods of his life, he was cracking jokes left and right with me. And I remember there's this joke in one of the chapter of the book where I write about the coup. And he's like, he was like sort of talking and he goes like, sneaky backstabbing bastards. Like, come at me from the front. There's like 12 of you. Why don't you like stab to stab me in the back, you know? And he's being facetious and a little sarcastic. But I will say that's like the other thing I you know, I came to appreciate that he'll never miss an opportunity to crack a joke. And it doesn't always go over well, but he's somebody who has a real sense of humor that's almost like a boyish sense of humor. And I think that's important for people who are paying attention to what he does, which is if you watch his videos and you turn the sound off, you watch the video, you'll notice he's like always sort of smirking, and you can tell he's like so tempted to tell a joke at different moments. And I don't think I really appreciated that until like I interviewed him and really kind of dove into this story that like he's trying to crack jokes a lot of the time, not all the time, but a lot of the time.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting because I think Elon comes across so much better in interviews than he does sometimes on Twitter. And I think that's probably part of it, is that like sometimes, like you said, sometimes the jokes don't always land in the first place in person, where you have a little bit of an advantage with, you know, body language and things like that. And then it's like, you try to translate that to Twitter. It's a step further. And sometimes it's
also, by the way, I suppose the question, taking a step back, is like, how would you do some of what he has done in the world without having a sense of humor? You know, like, if you were grim and stony and like super serious, like it'd be really hard to, you know, to kind of do some of the things he's done, because if you didn't have a sense of humor, I'm not sure how you would get through life. Like, and let me take a step back actually, because one of the things that you focused on this period of his life later, meaning the Tesla years, and I haven't. And so you have this whole body of knowledge about those years, but the period of time in which I really focused, which is 98 to 2002, you know, people look at it and they're like, oh, like he made a lot of money and he sold two companies. And sure, he also like almost died in a car accident, almost died because of malaria meningitis, got kicked out of this company that he created, and lost a child, all in the space of 4 years. And I don't know how I would recover from even one of those things. But it's in the immediate aftermath of those four things, two near-death experiences, losing a child, and being kicked out of the company he created, that he starts SpaceX and, you know, invests in and then runs Tesla. I think that's often also lost. Like we start the story like when, you know, at like age 35 or something. Like it's like we forget the first 35, like whatever number of years. And I hope that people who read the book, maybe even people who are skeptical of Elon, at least appreciate that this is not somebody that was that has faced sort of a glide path to these things, right? That actually, like, these 4 years were the most. I mean, any one of those would break another person.
Yeah, I think that's what's most frustrating to me when I just like kind of read, you know, the mainstream opinion about Elon, where it's kind of just like, oh, you know, he's been an investor and those investments have gone well, and like, good for you. Like, oh, you saw electric vehicles coming. It's like, are you joking? Like, this is not at all close to the reality. Like, this guy's been, you know, working 15-hour days, 16-hour days for like decades. Like,
so do you want to, here's a funny story that never made it into the book, is that I have no reason to make it into the book. So when I had the chance to interview him, this is pre-COVID, it was an in-person interview, and I kind of like show up at the place, and I like walk in, and it's like a little like foyer area. And he comes out and he shakes my hand and turns around and starts walking to like his living room or something, right? And I walk behind him, and there's like an awkward moment, because like, I don't know what to say, you know, like, how do you break the, you know, and like, it's like, what do you say? You know, it's like, you know, I haven't been there before. I've never met him. He doesn't know me from Adam. We're not there with friends. It's not a cocktail party. So I said the only thing I could think to say, because it was a Saturday, and I said, Elon, I just want to say, like, thanks for doing this, like, on a weekend. I really appreciate it. He had kids. I figured, like, you know, it's like a thing. And without missing a beat, he I don't even think he fully turned around, but he kind of, like, angled himself to me and, like, sort of, like, did it over his shoulder and was like, well, I work 7 days a week, so whatever. And it was like this, like, I remember being sort of put in my place a little bit, because I was like, whoa, like, this is real, you know, like, okay, it was like a throwaway comment, and I didn't really think too much about it. But for him, it was like, well, I work 7 days a week, and this is actually like, it is, that is who he is. And I think that's like often lost in, because, you know, we only read, sometimes people only read the headlines. Like, it's pretty hard. Like, if all you see is him hosting SNL, buying Twitter, you're like, oh, like, whatever, this is like a normal 9-to-5 type of life. But it's really not. Like, actually, the engineering challenges that he's put out set out to solve, like that's what it requires. It requires somebody who looks at you and says, "Oh, I work every weekend anyway, so what's the big deal?"
For sure. No, that's one of the questions I had on my list too, and maybe that answers it. But yeah, I was just going to kind of ask if there's anything that you didn't get a chance to, you know, cover in the book that you find interesting, maybe not necessarily related to the PayPal story or something like that just didn't fit contextually, or anything else that you just, you know, found really interesting throughout the process.
Yeah, I, you know, there's so much. Like, we could do an entire like hour just on that question. I would say there's a few things. It is in the book, but I don't think that we could that people fully appreciate how close he came to death in the year 2000 from the malaria and the meningitis. And the reason I say that is because I had what other people wouldn't have had until you know those emails sort of surfaced, which is the notes from colleagues at X.com and PayPal about visiting him in the hospital and about seeing like what the process was to figure out exactly which infectious disease it was and all of that. Like, he was very close to death. And it was one of these things that surprised me because I'd seen it written about in Ashley Vance's book and a couple of other places. And but I don't think I like fully understood the severity until I read some of the back and forth at the corporate level. That was one thing that really surprised me. I would say the other thing that this is a very small fact, but it was a fun fact, and I think it'll appeal to people like you who care about the details and your listeners. When I was like, one of the things about these books is they can become really boring if you just cover the same ground that everybody else covers. So one of the things that I did is I went to like the archives of the Daily Pennsylvanian online, which was like, he was a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. And I just started like rooting around for like over several years of archives to see like, has he ever mentioned, did he ever like write an op-ed for the school paper or something? You know, like you never know. And this took a long time, by the way, like I went and super nerded out on this, but I found his campaign platform for student government and I published it in the book. So it's all there, right? But I didn't know that he had tried to run for student government. He didn't win, like another butterfly effect thing. Like, what if he had ended up like really loving student government for some reason, right? But it was this cool moment of like, whoa, like, you know, and you read the platform and it is reaching for humor. He's trying to be funny, but he also has this serious moment at the end where he says, like, I think it's important to try to, you know, improve things and whatever, and I want to do good in the world or something like that, right? And it was kind of an epic moment. Like, I stumbled on it and we don't have to go into all the details, but I like, it took a while to find that nugget. And I think part of what it showed me is like, to some degree, like his character is very much the same sort of person. This person who is laughing at himself and the world, but also has this desire to do something consequential in the world. And you see it in this little paragraph from his Daily Pennsylvanian days that I found and stuck in the middle of the book.
I love that too, because it like very early on, like you're mentioning, there's this like bigger purpose mentality to it, where one of the lines that he has in there is, if anyone ever sees me put this position, if I win, if anyone ever sees me put this position on my resume, I'll go out in the town square, I'll stand on my head and I'll eat like 50 copies of like, you know, paper copies of
that's
of
right.
the resume. So it's like, he's trying to tell people there with, you know, a bit of humor that I'm not doing this for personal gain to like get this on my resume. Like, often those types of positions in college are for like you're trying to build up your resume, get anything on there that you can to like take that next step. And he's saying, hey, like that's the self-serving nature that this, you know, these types of offices have always had, and like I'm telling you that that's not why I'm doing this. I literally just want things to be better, you know. And it's very clear, and it's just like a sentence in there, but
that's
I think we've seen that carry through in like everything that Elon has done, and it doesn't always come across that way, but it's, you know, it's just, I feel like it's a core tenet of Elon that people just like don't want to believe, you know, but it's been there, you know, forever.
And I think a lot of the what happens, and again, like, by the way, I'm very fair. I try to be fair in the book. So when he is by you know, based on my research, like when other people would say these were the things that went wrong, I definitely like put those on paper, and I also tried to put on paper his explanation for why he was doing things. So people will have to make their own judgments, right? But I tried to be fair to both sides. So I don't want to make it seem like, oh, this was just like me, like as a stenographer. Like the reason I went back and read all those emails is because I wanted the truth, not because I wanted one person's perspective. But I do think, like, as I look at it, as somebody who, you know, I don't write about tech every day, this is not like my thing. I just did this particular historical project because I like histories. He is very much somebody whose character has stayed the same over the years. The risk-taking, the humor, the passion for science and technology, the really deep interest in physics and space, space exploration, these are not new things. Meaning he didn't make a bunch of money and then decide to get interested. When I interviewed his college boss and his mentor, Dr. Peter Nicholson, you know, one of the things Dr. Nicholson said is like, this is who he has been. Like when he and I were spending time together at Scotiabank, we were talking about space and we were doing math puzzles and like trading these things. He was like, this is actually the person that you're seeing. And he had that same intensity and that same precociousness. So it is actually interesting to me to have studied it and then to have like all of this, all the world focus on it. Cause I didn't know that. Like, it's like, you know, didn't know the last 6 months would happen because people look at it and they sort of see this person that came out of nowhere, but actually like this is the same person who, when he was an intern, as you said, at the bank, like wrote a memo or wrote, you know, tried to get the CEO to take a big risk with the bank's money because he saw an opportunity. So I just think that it's rare. It's rare that somebody would hold to their convictions that way, like over all this time. And it's actually one of the parts of the story that I think is really inspiring.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I think a lot of people right now are, you know, the market's down, whatever, Tesla's down 60%. And I think it's, you know, a lot of questions arise during periods of time like that. And not saying that this is your point of view, but just some added context from my point of view, it's, mm-hmm. it's a great time for me to kind of read that and just, you know, it's like a stupid way of saying it, but just kind of like reconnect with the person that I have known Elon to be from the outside, of course, but just, you know, I've been doing this every day for 5 years, and, you know, over that period of time, you kind of pick things up and, like you said, try to get to the truth. Like, I'm not someone that started my podcast because I'm like an Elon fanboy or something. It's just like, right. I've just tried to find out the truth, and like that's what I've found to be the case. So, that's kind of an aside, but I just think it was a good time to read it, and especially with the Twitter stuff.
I would say also, like, this was a useful thing for me as a humanities person and somebody who spends a lot of his time like writing and reading, is, you know, there's this great book that Tracy Kidder wrote in the 1980s called The Soul of a New Machine. And when it debuted, it won the Pulitzer Prize, and it was one of the first close looks at engineering culture. And like, what does it mean to be an engineer, a computer engineer? And Tracy Kidder like embeds himself inside this company for like 6 months, and he's like a fly on the wall. So he gets to be a part of all the conversations, and he gets to kind of see how computer engineers do their work, right? And I think to properly understand, you know, Elon and the people around him, you have to, it's the challenge of being a writer type is like, engineering and the way that it is done is a little different, and the culture is different. And so that is like part of what I tried to bring to life in the book, was this idea of like building things with pieces of code, right? It's like a fundamentally different kind of exercise than many of us are accustomed to. And I think it is why like the understanding of, say, for example, like things like, I don't know, like, again, I don't follow these closely, but like all the debates over like full self-driving or like the betas or like any of that stuff, I understand a little differently now, because what I think of in my mind when I think about that is this like, late night, there's pizza boxes open, there's a ton of caffeine in the room, and there's a bunch of engineers who are all bedraggled, and they are trying to solve very big problems, and they're having the kind of runner's high that I get when I like have a sentence snap into place and something just works about a paragraph. And I don't think that that's like an intuitive way to read a lot of the news about him, because a lot of the news about him is not written by engineers. It's written by non-engineers, and it's written about financial issues, wealth made, wealth lost, investments made, investments lost, slightly embarrassing moments. But if you look at it from a totally different perspective, you're like, well, what is he trying to do? There are groups of engineers that he is trying to inspire to do what seems impossible, and he has a track record of actually pulling that off against very aggressive timelines. That's very different than where a stock price is that day, right? Because it leads you to like, well, yeah, like that's like fine. Like that's like, you know, that is what it is. It's there. But actually the real challenge is, you know, X. And so, you know, again, it's not Pollyanna to say that either, because I think that a lot of the coverage, even about Wall Street, is not written by engineers. It's written by people who are word people. And I put myself in that camp, and it took me so much effort listening and talking to engineers and reading all these old engineering forums from like 2000 and 2001 to even begin to try to get in that mindset. But I think that's like one of the other key, like if somebody said like, what's something you could do? It's like, anytime you read something, just be like, listen to who's been quoted. And then also like, remember like, is this relevant to the engineering problem that he is trying to solve, or that this company, insert the company, is trying to solve? Like that's for me, helped me kind of like have a little bit of like, okay, let's like think about this, like take a step back. And again, I'm not a fan. I'm not a critic. I'm somebody who tried to write the truth, but it helped me to view it from an engineering lens.
For sure. And I think when you're talking about like not being a fan, not being a critic, I do think the book comes across very much that way. So it's, you know, I don't want to sit here and like, obviously I'm a fan of Elon, a fan of Tesla, and I don't want to people to think that that's the only reason we're having this conversation. It's not.
No,
it's
I
because
know.
Of like what you talk about with just all the detail, and you know, that's what I'm a fan of. So
and I would say too that like a lot of what's missed is hopefully what I captured, which is, you know, people are like, oh, you know, they'll say some good thing about him or some bad thing about him. And sometimes what I'll try to think about is like, part of the reason I'm glad I interviewed people who he hired is because his approach to recruiting and hiring is really different from other CEOs. Part of the reason that I am glad I interviewed people who saw him in the middle of a product launch is because his approach to launching products is really different. And so part of what I tried to do was just sort of like separate out the noise. Let's like get at how does he actually run a company? And that I think, I mean, I tried to make that come across because it's not typical. And like it leads to atypical successes and also, you know, a lot of ferocious criticism. But I think that is worth learning from and really, really trying to understand. Because if you look at it from that way, it like becomes a different kind of story.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you're saying there with like, it's almost like an engineering mindset versus a business mindset versus like, you know, word mindset or whatever. But you know, there's a reason that we see consistently SpaceX and Tesla at the top of the lists for, you know, most desirable positions from surveys of engineering students in college. So it's exactly what you're talking about. Like Elon, however he's doing it, has just found a way to inspire those types of people and bring them together and have, you know, facilitate the creation of great things. And like we're talking about, that track record goes back, you know, decades in multiple different disciplines. So it's just fun to see that play out.
Yeah. And I think it'll continue, you know, part of the, I think that we talked about this earlier, this is kind of how we kicked things off, but his appetite for risk is so big that we're so far from done, right? That like, actually like this, because this is not about adding zeros to the net worth, that this is about some fundamental problems and challenges in engineering, physics, energy, communications, that these are, that the story is far from done because his appetite for risk is big and he will continue to place these bets and then see what he can do to inspire engineers to get there.
Absolutely. It's going to be exciting to follow. You know, every day is a new day with Elon, so it's fun to see. That's probably a good place to kind of wrap it up. Is there anything else that we didn't really cover yet that, you know, you feel like is important to mention to people?
You know, this is just interesting because it'll be interesting to the people who listen to you in particular, but I had this experience of like trying to understand the passion that he has for the McLaren F1. And I'd advise like everybody listening to like spend a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, if you have the time, to really dive into the history of the McLaren F1. Because people look at that episode in his life, and for those who don't know, you know, he had this moment when he had sold Zip2, where he purchased a McLaren F1, this supercar, right? And it was like $1 million or something, and it was a huge amount of his net worth, and he was like competing against like big time celebrities for it, but he got the car. He didn't insure it. There was a famous car accident. This is one of the near-death experiences. And I, you know, you can look at that, like, let's say you look at the surface, like the surface interpretation of that. Oh, you know, rich Silicon Valley person buys a fancy car. No, that is like the wrong interpretation of that series of events. Here's what I came to understand. The McLaren F1, when it debuted, was an automotive marvel. It was like as close to like the platonic ideal of a supercar as you could get. So it was this incredible piece of engineering. And I would urge people to go back and read the press about it from like 1998, 1999, and 2000, because you'll read superlatives about a car that sound like they're about some kind of deity, right? Like there's this one Car and Driver article where they're like, the history of the car can be separated into like pre-McLaren and post-McLaren. It like forever changed the trajectory of, you know, and it's that sort of stuff. And it made me, when I went back and did that research, it made me appreciate the things that he appreciated about the car, which is that when they started from a blank sheet of paper. And they said, if you're going to make the world's perfect car, how would you do it? That is really cool to learn. And then, and this is, speaks to you and like your commitment to telling the daily story of Tesla. There's this gentleman that I met who was super active on all the McLaren forums. And it took me like a while to track him down. I finally found out who he was because he was writing pseudonymously. I couldn't like track his name down. Finally found him on Facebook. And he gave me a 3-hour seminar on the history of the McLaren F1 and then sent me a bunch of photos of Elon's specific McLaren. I included one of those images in the middle of the book, which was the ad for his specific McLaren. But I think for people who are passionate about about Tesla and about the automotive innovations, it's worth like going back and just like nerding out on the McLaren piece, because it reformulates how you think about how he thinks about cars. Even today, I think he tweeted, or like, I'm sorry, like a few years ago, he tweeted, it's like somebody asked him like what his favorite car is. And he's a car company CEO. And I think he tweeted back like the McLaren F1, right? This is somebody like runs a car company. Like he didn't say the Model X, he didn't, you know? And so it was interesting to me to go back and understand it, because it is a work, it's like a work of art. It's like a work of engineering art. And that was how he thought about that automobile. And so I would just, you know, if people have spare time, there's a bunch of good YouTube documentaries. There's a bunch of history that's been written about this. There's a couple of books that are actually kind of pricey books, but it's worth really like diving into it, because it's one of those moments where you're like, wow, you know, you come to appreciate it the way a connoisseur would, where you're like, this is not just a fast car. There are plenty of fast cars. There are Ferraris, there are Lamborghinis. The McLaren F1 is something different. And you may have more to say on this than I do, because you may have looked at this as well.
No, you definitely have more insight and information on that than I do. Like, I remember kind of part of the story kind of tracks like the, you know, post Elon crash life of that McLaren F1 and like how it's, you know, it's such an important vehicle that they don't just like total it and that's it. You know, they send it off to like McLaren like hospital.
That's
and
right.
They like do surgery on it and, you know, fix it up. And I think someone still owns it to this day, right?
Yes. To this day, it was reconstructed entirely. It actually got into like a second car accident. And then but it still is, it's alive and well, and it's been rehabilitated. And it's a quite, it's, you know, because there are so few of these cars that were made, people have obsessively tracked like the story of each McLaren. And this one just happens to have an owner that, you know, ended up creating a car company. So it's all the more interesting.
For sure. All right. Awesome. That's a great place to end it, Jimmy. Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks so much for the work that you did over the last 6 years to make this incredible book. Again, just, you know, I'm glad that we've got the record of it and all this insight. And yeah, definitely recommend everyone in the audience to check it out, regardless of your level of interest in PayPal or anything like that in the financial space. Like there's so many more lessons to be learned and just interesting stories that are, you know, weaved in and out of there. And it goes beyond Elon too. Like we're obviously talking more about Elon here, but there's, you know, a lot of other players here that are doing a lot of cool things today too. And yeah, it's just fun to see those circles intertwine. And we were talking about Confinity and X.com and how they were, you know, button heads for a while there. They were neighbors in the same office building before they even realized that they were competitors. Like,
yeah.
It's like how serendipitous is that? It's just like insane. Some of the, you know, tales that are woven here. So it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me and indulging my nerding out on this.
Absolutely. That's what we're all about at Tesla Daily, just getting real into the weeds as far as we can. But yeah, thanks so much, Jimmy. Really appreciate it. And yeah, hopefully we'll have an occasion to talk again soon.
I would love that. That'd be so fun. By the way, where are you geographically?
I'm in Milwaukee. We'll see how long that lasts, but for now I'm in Milwaukee, yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, if I ever come that way or if you ever come to New York, let me know. It'd be fun to get together in person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome, man.
All right,
have a good
thanks,
one.
Jimmy.